Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Test 1, 2. Hi, friends. Nice to see you. Good to be back. My name is Dean, and here we go. Getting ready to leave for Alberta today. Alberta, the home of the mountains, the foothills, oil, and two hockey teams, one that's still in the playoffs. Can't say the same thing with the Toronto Maple Leafs, who lost in Game 7 again the other night. That was a lot of fun, wasn't it? Huh? Isn't that fun to watch? Game 7 again against Boston again? It's like every year, every second year. Doesn't really matter. Apathy's all time. I love it. I love it. There's a bunch of people out there who are like, I can't handle this. I'm never watching it. No. You got to keep watching this. The Cubs went through it for like 112 years. You can do this. It's only been like 57, 58 next year. Just relax. Just relax. Not that anybody's going to watch anymore in the city of Toronto, which is where I'm located. Again, heading to Calgary today and going to be chatting with David Parker from Take Back Alberta. We've got a slate of things that we're going to be doing, and my guest today comes from Alberta as well. He actually helped me interview David Parker a while ago, and was my introduction to him. Please welcome award-winning columnist, the lead columnist from Canada's National Observer, Mr. Max Fawcett, who has a fancy mug there. Oh, Jesus, I caught you mid-sip.
Yeah, guilt caught me red-handed, but yeah, no, thank you for the... Thank you for the now obligatory plug about me being an award-winning columnist. It's in my rider now.
It should be. Dude, you won a big award this week. Tell me about it before we get started and before we start talking about that killer mug. Tell me about your award.
Sure, it's the Mary Ann Cad Shaddy. Mary Ann, oh boy, I'm going to butcher this. Mary Ann Shad Award. Mary Ann Shad Carey Award. It's a lot of names. Mary Ann Shad Carey. She was a, you know, highly... impressive and reputable figure from Canadian history, a very talented columnist and journalist, and apparently I am as well, which is nice to hear. So, yeah, I was at the National Newspaper Awards 2 weeks ago, almost less. I was getting on a plane back to Calgary from a vacation out west and got some lovely texts. And, yeah, it was, you know, it's always fun to win them.
Yeah.
It's more fun to win them than it is to get nominated. So, that's who I am now, I guess.
Award winner. Is this your first journalism award? Is your first award?
No.
Look at that.
No, I've won a bunch of magazine awards, but this is the first newspaper award that I've won, which is
really
because I mean, I was always a magazine guy. And obviously they're sort of stretching the definition of newspaper because I work for an online publication, but you know, the more the merrier in that space. And I, the other finalists, one of them was from the National Post. One of them was from the Winnipeg Free Press, which are very much, more conventional newspapers. So it was a good day for us. And it's actually the second time in 3 years that the National Observer has had a columnist win that award. So, I have to sort of put a plug in for the organization and the work that we do, because I think it speaks to the quality of it.
Well, yeah, you guys do such a good job. Canada's National Observer is very, very responsible, very fun, very cool, very accountable. Digital online outlet is one of the fastest growing and has been for quite some time. What is your slant? Like, what I want to get to the awards in a second, but what is the National Post do? Because it writes a lot about climate change. You talk a lot about renewable energy, very accountable when it comes to people that, you know, we call them liars in your business. They're called politicians, right? People that just do politics, but you try to sift through the bullshit, when it comes to a better Canada. That's what it feels like at Canada's National Observer.
That's a good plug. First time you said National Post and what do they do? They get old white men angry about stuff, but you know, what do? We try to keep people abreast of what's happening on the climate front. Certainly, you know, it started as a Vancouver-based publication, very opposed to pipelines. And as I've said a few times, like I was actually on the other side of that back then with them, because I was the editor of Alberta Oil Magazine. And so it's an interesting sort of relationship, the way it's evolved with us, where, you know, I used to be an antagonist and now I'm their lead columnist. But they've expanded to take a more national approach because climate is obviously a national issue, and you know, have expanded into other areas of, you know, I would say a more progressive approach of covering, you know, national politics. And I think that will only continue to grow and get bigger, you know, especially as we head into the next election. You know, if God forbid Pierre Poilievre defunds the CBC, I mean, the whole media landscape could completely destabilize by then. National Post might be bankrupt. So there's lots of opportunities, I think, for an organization like ours to kind of fill the void that is being created on various fronts. And that's what we're trying to do.
That's kind of what you do too. You know, you've done a series of these versus podcasts with us, right? Where we'll bring people who you vehemently oppose on social media. And as someone who is a journalist, like there's a big difference between guys like Max Fawcett and me. I ham and egg it. I'm a podcaster. I'm just a dude with a big mouth. That's what I do. That's my currency. Max is, and I'm a professional at it. Got my 10,000 hours. Max is a professional journalist. I am none of those things. And to your point, something that you do as a professional journalist, you don't see a lot of people do this anymore because it comes with a lot of heat, if you will, is you'll step across the aisle and get out of your silo, get out of that weirdness, and you'll interview anybody. You've interviewed some Bitcoin guys here on the show. We had David Parker on the show together. I'm coming out there actually today, this afternoon, so I'll be at your front door looking for some toothpaste because I'll probably forget mine. But you interviewed Eva Chipiak a while ago as well, and someone who I love mocking online when she doesn't know how passports work. And I think she's one of the Convoy specialty victims, if you will. But a lot of people didn't want you talking to her as well. And you know, I find that fascinating and a real point of difference. I feel the same way because of my discipline, which is podcast, spoken word, these things, is that you should be allowed to, you should be able to talk about anything and anyone in the public square in some kind of accountable or responsible way, right? I noticed that in your space, the difference between people like you is your values don't get in the way of the story that you want to tell, right? Is that tough for you in today's environment, you know, where you'll take heat for telling stories or talking about people or two people, getting their side of whatever it is that you don't agree with, and then you get people to come around and go, I can't believe you're actually giving that person your time?
I think one of the biggest, I don't want to say strengths, but assets that I have is I don't really care what other people think about me. There are certain people who I care deeply what they think, you know, people who I respect, people I've known for a long time, family, my wife, what have you. But people on the internet, I really couldn't give a fuck. So, if people are upset with me because I'm talking to the wrong people, they can always tune out. They don't have to follow me. That's perfectly okay for them to retreat into their silo. But I think it's important for us to talk to people who disagree with us and who don't share our values. That used to be something we were much more able to do. Obviously, social media has kind of degraded that because, you know, there's that joke about, or there's mockery of safe spaces. But I think to some extent, all of us are creating these safe spaces in our social lives where we tend to hear from people we agree with, we tend to talk to people we agree with, we tend to hear the takes we want to agree with. And I think, I'm sure that's comfortable. I don't think it gives you an accurate picture of the way the world actually is and how other people are thinking. And so, you know, you see this with progressives who just can't understand why young people would want to vote for Pierre Poilievre. You know, you see polls coming out where the CPC is polling at 20 points ahead of the NDP or the Liberals. And that's because folks like that have a view of young people that isn't stress tested by going outside of their silo and kind of encountering other perspectives. So, you know, there's definitely people I won't talk to. There's definitely people who, you know, who are neo-Nazis or you know, people who are just malevolent bad actors. And I'm sure there are some folks who think that David Parker fits that description, but I don't. I think David, I don't agree with him. I think the way he conducts himself is often, you know, highly disreputable, but he has a perspective and a worldview, and he forces people to put their votes where their mouths are. You know, he's organizing, he's bringing people out to vote, and you have to be able and willing to confront that. I think, if you sort of retreat into your own silo and say, well, I'm just not going to engage with him, he's going to win every single time. And so that's why I want to talk to these people, in large part because, you know, I think we saw this with Eva Chipiak. You know, she interviewed me for her podcast. She was not prepared for someone who had command of the facts and a different worldview. It was not someone she's talked to. She's used to talking to people who agree with her about the convoy.
Where's that interview? Because I want to listen to it. I just heard you say she wasn't prepared for someone that had some facts in front of them. So now I'm really piqued.
I mean, unless she's taken it down from her podcast, I think it's episode, gosh, I want to say 13. That's a funny number, but it's a couple episodes back. And then she went back to interviewing people she agrees with, like Shane Wenzel, the home builder here in Calgary and whatnot. Yeah. But, I feel like as a columnist, as someone who has opinions for a living, it's kind of my job to go and take those opinions into places where they may not be well received. You know, like this was back when I was the editor of Alberta Oil. There was a theatrical presentation in Vancouver about pipelines. All of the sort of celebrity expert, whatever guests were anti-pipeline. The only person they could find to defend pipelines was me. Of course, all the industry advocates refused to do it because they're cowards. And so I went to Vancouver and I defended pipelines, and it was a totally constructive conversation. I probably changed a couple of minds. I'm sure most people there, you know, still believed what they believed, but it was important for me to do it. And that's sort of what I'm doing with these conversations with folks like Eva Chipiak.
Yeah. And you know what, it's funny. I don't have, people want you to stand on their morals, and like you, anybody that likes to apply some critical thought to every situation in front of them, it's easy to not do it. And it's easy to stay safe. You know, I'm willing to put myself in the line of fire because I don't care. And it's not that I don't care about what other people think, but to your point, there are very few people that you curate as a journalist or as a podcast or as someone in the content game. Very few people you'll curate this little circle that you trust enough to go to them and say, what do you think of me doing this? And in this case, when I talk to someone like you or Moskrop, who's got no problem going on with Mike Lake and a couple of other guys on their podcasts every Friday where they sit and shoot the shit about real issues, there's this idea out there that you can't cross streams with people who have a different ideology than you. And when I say that, and I understand that from a perspective of hurtful, right? A guy like David Parker. David Parker's ideologies come out in policies in your province because of he is the spine of the United Conservative Party. You know that. I know that, as is Take Back Alberta. And the unpopular policies like the anti-trans thing for kids, the unpopular policies where it comes to Bill 18 or Bill 20, and I want to get into that, is people think that because you want to go and have that conversation that you're going to whitewash what it is that these people are all about. And it's almost like a foregone conclusion where someone will say to you, you know, I can't believe you're going to platform that person. And you're like, dude, here's the thing. I want to get into the minds of these people because I disagree with them. And then they'll go on, specifically on the left, this happens on the left specifically, they will go on a tangent where they will contact all of your partners. They'll send emails to your boss. Thank God I'm my boss. They'll contact people that you work with. They'll contact clients, and they'll say, I want you to know, in this case, this has already happened to me today, I want you to know Dean is going to interview a Nazi.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah.
What do you do? What do you do? You just have to do the content, because I'm not going to not do it, right? Like, only a moron would get an invite from one of the most contentious, enigmatic groups in political history in this country to get behind the scenes and see what's really important to them and how they got to where they are in Take Back Alberta. Only a moron would say no thanks.
Well, and I think some people have forgotten what the job of journalists and journalist adjacent, let's call it, you know, podcasters, what their job is. It's not to determine and rank and sort who is acceptable and who is not acceptable. It is to talk to people. It is to talk to as many people as possible who are relevant to the issue at hand, who have knowledge or currency, and then give that to their readers, listeners, and let them decide, right? It's not this idea of like, well, because you're talking to person X, you're validating them or you're platforming them and therefore they have credibility. That should never be how, you know, a conversation should be perceived. A conversation is just a conversation. And, you know, more often than not, I think if progressives were more willing to go into these spaces, I think they would find that it would be to their benefit. Number one, because they would be able to stress test their ideas, their values. And number two, that they would be able to introduce new information into environments that are often very deprived of information. Mm. You know, but it takes a little bit of courage. It takes a willingness to, you know, get yelled at by your own side and get yelled at by the other side. But, you know, as long as you keep your head and understand what your job is, especially as a journalist, which is to just ask questions and get to the truth in as much as you can get to it, you're going to be okay.
Mm. How do you do it? How do you do it? And you've grown into the journalist you are, right? You've grown into being the lead columnist for Canada's National Observer. Thank you very much. I crushed it that time. I only had you on the show 100 times. You've grown into it. How do you get past the fear part? How do you get past the anxiety part? Is it something you've ever had to deal with? Because a lot of people are saying that to me too. Is like, aren't you afraid? I'm like, fuck no. I'm just going to go have a conversation with a guy I disagree with on certain things. And, you know, there are certain things we agree with. There are connections there. And so it's easier for me. But when you go in blind, how do you, as a journalist, speaking to young journalists, how do you tell them, hey, listen, get past your fear of what might happen in that interview? Because it's a real thing for a lot of people to do what you do, and you have a special gift and not having that gear where you're like, maybe I shouldn't do this because it might make me feel sad.
I mean, I think a lot of it is experience, right? It's just knowing that going into these situations where maybe you feel a little uncertain or a little nervous, it'll be okay, right? Yeah. Whatever happens. I mean, I've gone through basically having the American right-wing conservative machine try to cancel me, and it didn't work. I've had Ezra Levant do a long rant about me, and when I was at Alberta Oil Magazine trying to get me fired, that didn't work. You have to kind of have the awareness and the knowledge that you will get through this, and your own values will be kind of your sail that gets you to the next destination. And I don't want to compare journalism or anything we do to combat, because obviously it's not, but a part of it is just like the more time you spend at the front, the less the bullets whizzing by you bother you. Yeah. Right. You're like, all right, that's another, you know, that's a shell coming from this position. It's not going to hit us. Don't worry about it. Get some sleep. And it's hard to do that when you're fresh to the front. So, I think that's sort of the challenge. And part of the problem is that because journalism is so financially challenged right now, a lot of people don't spend enough time in the trenches to get that experience. You know, they graduate from journalism school, maybe they work a few jobs in journalism, and then they're off to do PR or GR or whatever it is by the time they're in their early 30s. They haven't built up the scar tissue that you used to build up just by being a journalist for decades on end, right? We've lost that kind of institutional knowledge, the people in their 40s, 50s who have seen a lot of things, because there just aren't enough jobs and enough opportunities out there for people to have the time in the trench.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, you bring up a great point, is that, you know, the calluses that you build up when you're out there doing shit, you know, the receipts of you not caring have to come with you having the ability to stay calm in that moment. Have you always had that ability to stay calm in an interview, not get triggered emotionally? Is that something you've had to work on over time?
I mean, I'm sure there are people who know me would say I'm still having to work on, you know, maintaining my emotional balance during moments of stress. But I think I guess I was advantaged because I did a lot of theater when I was a kid. And you learn how to kind of turn on the mask in performance moments and kind of channel discipline and channel a sense of kind of separation from your ego. So, you know, again, the drama is always a good way to build up some skills as a kid, and would recommend that to anyone. But yeah, just sort of a confluence of thing. I had a dad who was a writer who really kind of put me through my paces in terms of responding to critical feedback. And so it's just kind of this confluence of a bunch of different things that I guess allowed me to keep my cool in as much as I could in those situations. But again, it's just practice, right?
It's like anything. You tell people that all the time. Is like, and they'll. I get people that ask me, like, when you're interviewing somebody, how are you able to not get angry at them when they lie? How are you able to not get angry at them when they try to gaslight? And I'm like, because I'm not doing it. That's not what I'm there for, right? I'm there to ask these people questions. My face will tell the story. And when I get real hot, and you've been on those interviews too, when I get real hot about something, I'll just give it to them. I'll tell them exactly how I feel. But there, we've got this level of anxiety that comes with conflict now that you know, say it's social media's fault. You can say it's, you know, not having enough human interaction, where people literally live behind their screens and all they're trying to do is trying to affect the way the world doesn't affect them, right? Like, that's what I find the most exhilarating about pissing people off on the extreme left. It's like, oh, you don't want me to talk to that guy because you're afraid that you might like something he actually says, but you hate the individual because you hated other things that person has said.
Or he might find it amazing.
Go ahead.
Or he might make good points, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. I genuinely don't understand what the risk is in having someone like that get more exposure, because if you believe that he's as bad as he is, that will prove out, right? People will see that. People will hear that. It kind of betrays a lack of trust in other people's critical thinking and critical faculties, that they're somehow going to be bamboozled by these people if they get more oxygen. And I just don't think that that's true. I also, you know, like you say, I think a lot of people just don't have any practice these days with being in a space with someone they disagree with and knowing how to disagree respectfully, right? And and maybe part of that's on universities. You know, it used to be that you would have these sort of barn burner debates in classes. I certainly remember having them on stuff that, you know, in the fullness of time doesn't matter even a tiny bit, but you learn, the skills you learn are how to disagree with people. And I don't even think that's allowed in universities anymore. I think there is so much kind of fear in the atmosphere around, you know, hurting people's feelings and being offended and people taking offense and weaponizing that offense, that people have lost the art of having a robust disagreement without, you know, without it escalating to a personal attack or something. Right.
You see that the stuff that's going on in Canadian and American universities, the Gaza protest stuff, the stuff around Israel, the stuff around Gaza. I have stayed largely out of that conversation. I'm glad you brought up universities, because, you know, if you know anything about universities and the 60s, the 70s, Kent State, if you understand that universities were really these kind of microcosms where you could have lively debate, and they have been for a couple hundred years, right? It's like, hey, bring your fascist guy here, bring your commie here, bring your libertarian here, and you'd have people in clubs, and this is where you explore different ideologies, different things. It's where you're educated in the worlds of secularism, philosophy, ideology, political science, all the things that go into. And then, you know, over time, people settle into what it is that they feel is right for them. That's how they do these things. I'm fascinated by the Israel-Gaza stuff, though, because, you know, I am not, as a University of Calgary person, as someone who went to university there for 4 years, did not graduate, by the way. I took a flyer at the end. I'm like, I'm out of here. I never saw any of this. I got to go to university in a time when, you know, it was all about, you know, Nirvana and varsity sports and poli-sci, and let's just get fucking through the day so we can go to the den and get hammered. That was what my experience was in university. I would love your take on what you're seeing now. Because depending on how you feel, depending on the videos you've consumed online, your worldview of what is going on in universities with this Gaza Israel stuff is extreme and probably wrong. But I would say this, is that as much as I hate all protests equally, these ones bother me more because I actually like them. I actually side with them, and not because I agree with any of the people that and what they're saying and what they're doing. And everybody that is involved in these mobs has got a different perspective, and they're there for a different reason. But after watching what I've watched over the past 4 or 5 years, I'm like, of course they're allowed to voice their opinion in a university square. Of course they are. And I feel that way about people here, but the university one, I, for whatever reason, bothers me more.
My sort of overarching philosophy here is that university is the place that you go to make mistakes and learn from those mistakes. And that can be personal mistakes, that can be intellectual mistakes. I mean, for goodness sakes, I almost went into the Faculty of Commerce. You know, that would have been a mistake. But the whole point is to make mistakes and learn and grow from them. And it feels to me, with the way that you know, campuses right now are, everything is videoed, everything is surveilled, you know, there's a record of everything you do, that students are not able to make mistakes. Or if they do, the cost, the penalty applied to them is so high. Mm-hmm. And so I see these protests that are happening in schools, and there's some very bad, dumb, lousy, shitty, racist behavior that is taking place. But I also see adults, politicians, you know, business leaders trying to kind of weaponize that and put it to their own advantage. And that's the part that I get uncomfortable with, is people trying to take the kind of mistakes and excesses of university students who are at an age where everything feels so important, so existential. They're going to go a little far in whatever belief they might have. Seeing people who know better than that trying to kind of weaponize that or use that to their advantage, that's what really bothers me. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, obviously if you're saying anything that is anti-Semitic, you gotta have a talking to about that. You gotta learn, you gotta pay a, you know, penance for that. Ditto if you're saying anything anti-Islamophobic or whatnot. But I also think that, you know, and the left has not been good on free speech in recent years, but we need to be willing, especially at that age and at that, in that space, to kind of give people a bit of leeway to learn from their mistakes. Because if they don't learn from them, then they're not going to learn from them later. Like if, you know, if someone is on campus behaving in ways that are, you know, not good, and, you know, they kind of carry that with them, they don't have the opportunity to learn and grow from it. That's how they're going to be for the rest of their life. Mm. And then we're dealing with a fully formed adult with bad instincts, bad sort of intellectual habits, bad beliefs, and that's much more dangerous, I think. And so I don't know how you unring the bell of social media, and you know, I know that these students are kind of getting a little high on their own supply on both sides of this issue, and that's just natural. That's again the sort of the excesses of that age. But you know, as with so many things, I don't think social media is helping here anyone.
No, and the rise in anti-Semitism that I've seen, and I've got great friends that you know, Dr. Michael Geist, who's just a wonderful academic, very smart man, comes from Holocaust survivors. I've never seen him this concerned, right? Yeah. I've never seen him this concerned. And the misguided hatred of Jewish people over, you know, Netanyahu, who is the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, and his government is the problem. They are not the Israeli people. And the same thing goes for people who paint every single person in a kafiyeh, you know, as a terrorist sympathizer. That is not the case either. You know, and to your point, usually you go to university to work those things out, right? But we're seeing people get dragged off by the police. We're seeing people get assaulted by the police, because is it that universities just don't like the visual of it? Like, what's the purpose? I don't understand it. I really don't.
I don't think they know what to do here, because they have created this idea over the last decade, two decades, whatever it might be, that universities are safe spaces, right? Mm-hmm. I fundamentally don't understand what that's supposed to mean. Like, I think universities should be safe spaces for experimentation, for learning, for interacting with different perspectives. I don't think it's a safe space where there's no conflict and no disagreement. But now, you know, we have this massive conflict and massive disagreement, and they almost have kind of painted themselves into their own corner here and don't really know what to do. And I don't think students know how to conduct themselves here either, right? It's this confluence of all these sort of bad trends, bad decisions. And, you know, I guess my overarching take here would be, if you are resolutely one way or the other, I think you are missing the real picture here, right? The rise in anti-Semitism is horrifying. And a lot of it comes from people being of a generation where they've never met anyone who, you know, was a Holocaust survivor or who descended from Holocaust survivors. You know, when I went to school, we met a couple of them, and it really kind of changes you. And this is a generation that maybe doesn't have that opportunity or doesn't have that experience. And by the same token, you have folks who are kind of willing to portray any opposition to the government in Israel and it's the war that it's conducting as anti-Semitic, and that is also just not a fair or honest position. So, you know, I think this is one of those situations where if we took all the social media and all the cameras away, we might be able to have a bit more of a constructive conversation. But A, that's not happening. And B, it's not going to have any impact on how things settle out in Israel and Gaza.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And I keep saying that all the time. This is happening, you know, 15,000 miles away. Why are you causing a problem here? You know, and it's a really simple, you know, it's how a simple person looks at everything. It's like, why are you inconveniencing me? Why can't I get around? Why are you in my way when I'm trying to drive across University Avenue? But I've said that about every protest. I've said that about the Freedom Convoy. I've said that about Gaza. I've said that about every single protest. I could care less where you come from. You catch more flies with honey than shit. And what we're doing is we're protesting on behalf of other authoritarian organizations and governments, right? Like, that's the thing that blows my mind. And people don't understand that. And to that point, I want to talk about authoritarianism in the province of Alberta. It's a word that's getting tossed around because of Bill 18 and Bill 20. Bill 20 seems to be the one that's caused the biggest kerfuffle. Can you explain Bill 20 and Bill 18 to us real quick?
Sure. So Bill 18 is basically the fuck off Ottawa bill. And it basically puts guardrails on agreements that provincial or that municipal entities like universities, like cities, like, you know, there's all sorts of municipal entities in every province. It puts guardrails on the agreements that it can make with the federal government. This was precipitated by, obviously, the feds coming in and trying to give money to the cities of Calgary and Edmonton for housing, provided they went along with the federal guidelines on, you know, the green building code, on density, on things like that. Quebec has done this for a while now. I really don't think that saying Quebec does something is like a get out of jail free card, but conservatives in Alberta really seem to think that that is all you have to say. Well, Quebec does it. Why can't we? And that's that sort of ends the debate. Bill 20 is the really sticky one, though, because Bill 20 is nominally aimed at addressing some election issues and sort of democratic governance issues. And so it imposes political parties on our municipal elections only in Calgary and Edmonton, nowhere else. Funny that this is sort of, you know, clearly a response to the fact that both Edmonton and Calgary have had progressive councils and mayors for the last decade. Conservatives cannot seem to understand why that's happening. And so now they're going to change the rules to give them a better shot of raising money and not having their votes get split between various candidates. You know, and everyone expected that. We all knew that was coming. That was telegraphed very clearly by the provincial government. The thing that's really got people's noses out of joint is some of the other stuff in that bill, which essentially allows the provincial government to postpone elections, to kick out councillors just at their whim. They can basically fire municipal councillors, remove them from council, and overrule bylaw decisions. So if Calgary passes as it is pushing towards right now, a bylaw that does a blanket upzoning for the entire city. So basically, now you can build a duplex or a row home anywhere in the city, which is common sense. You should be able to do that. It's more economic freedom for the homeowner. The province doesn't want that. And so what they could do under this bill is say, well, that's a nice bylaw that you passed, but we're going to overrule it. We're going to vacate that bylaw. That has councils in Edmonton and Calgary, but also in small towns in High River, where Danielle Smith is from, you know, across the province, pretty much up in arms over this, saying that, you know, this is fundamentally undemocratic. Mm. Like, yes, municipalities are creatures of the province in our constitution. It is not the same relationship as it is between provinces and the federal government. But when you give yourself the authority to Bigfoot every decision they make, kick out councillors and postpone elections, that's some pretty undemocratic shit. And, you know, people should be mindful of the fact that those rules would apply to a provincial government governed by the NDP if they win the...
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Next election. So this may all seem great and wonderful for conservatives, but imagine suddenly you have an NDP government in Edmonton and they're the ones who are throwing councillors off council, who are invalidating bylaws, who are postponing elections. I feel like conservatives in this province, and especially David Parker, would have a much bigger problem with that. And I put that to him on Twitter. I haven't heard back from him about it, but you know, he has said that his whole political philosophy is about localism. It's about having decisions be made closest to the people. This is not that. This is the opposite of that.
Mm. You know, he said something to me a couple of days ago. We were talking about tabulators. And, you know, we had a quick conversation on the phone because I'm coming out to interview him. And I'm like, you're all hot to trot out there this week. And he's like, yeah. Yeah, we're doing what we said we were going to do. Right. And did they not say that they were going to do this?
With the
Bill 20.
Not to this extent. They never said that they were going to give themselves the power to vacate bylaws or to postpone elections, all that stuff. And the tabulator stuff is just nuts because it's really like we've imported a conspiracy theory from the United States with no evidence to.
Yeah,
to
that's all Trump stuff, it. Right? Like that's all MAGA shit, which is like we can't trust computers. We don't know who's got their chips in those computers. And so, you know, this is very big steel response, I think. That's what it feels like. It feels like it's a J6 thing. It feels like it's like, no, we're going to fall in line with MAGA and we're going to use that as an excuse or some type of trigger to tell everybody that this is, we identify with that. 100%. Here in this province. That's that to me, it was more of a hat tip than it was anything else.
It was 100% a hat tip. And I'm fine with going back to hand counting ballots. Like I've been in count rooms for federal and municipal elections, provincial elections. I love the way we count ballots in this
country. It's probably real electric in there, isn't it?
Oh,
like 11 o'clock at night.
You would be surprised. But we can process the results of our elections pretty quickly just by counting ballots that are marked by paper. So I don't have any problem with that. It puts more money in the pockets of volunteers from Elections Alberta and Elections Canada who get to oversee that process rather than corporations who sell these voting machines. So again, no problem there. But like you say, it's a hat tip to the sort of conspiratorial fringes of the right who really believe that machines are the reason why they're not winning enough elections. And you know, the danger there is that you start letting that stuff into your political culture. It has a habit of spreading, I think. And it won't stop with just vote tabulators. It will go to other places that have a more direct impact on real issues and real things.
Yeah. And speak to the authoritarian portion of that, too. Right. I mean, we're not just talking about employing part of a conspiracy theory to make elections in Alberta better. You're talking about, you know, as you pointed out, yeah, 6 and 1/2 dozen. Doesn't matter how we count them as long as they get counted. So, you know, a smarter person would look at that statement and go, that's performative. You know, that largely that idea is performative. But the idea of centralizing power in municipalities around the entire province so that they can control who gets in, who gets out, and pull people out who won't do the bidding of the provincial government or who decide people in their municipality deserve housing in the form of a fourplex or a twoplex or affordable housing apartment building. And what it sounds like to me is a very authoritarian way to be able to say that you're being democratic, right? Which is like, hey, listen, you voted us here. Pierre Poilievre's repeating those same things right now with the notwithstanding bullshit, where he's like, you've elected me, so this is democracy at work. Doesn't it feel like a real authoritarian move, though, like an authoritarian power move or the start of it when you're saying to people who put councillors, mayors in different positions of their city to carry out the business of the city in that municipality, when they're removed, you're basically telling them your vote doesn't fucking matter to us at all. And we're going to do whatever we want to do anyway.
Yeah. I'm always careful with these sorts of terms because, you know, you see them thrown around a lot that, you know, so-and-so is a fascist, so-and-so is a communist, and that pollutes the political discourse. But I think it is fair to say that, you know, on the continuum of total democracy to total autocracy, Alberta is sliding the wrong way in quite alarming and quick fashion right now. My friend Jared Wesley, who is a professor at the University of Alberta, who writes about this sort of stuff. He came out with a Substack post last week, which I think has been picked up and I think published in the TIE now, but basically saying that like this is a real threat. This is real. This is a thing that is happening. This is, you know, authoritarian behavior, and it doesn't happen overnight. You know, you don't go straight from pure democracy to pure authoritarian regime. You start sliding and you have to kind of put up the roadblocks as civilians before it goes too far. You know, the UCP in Bill 18 is basically asking for the right to vet all funding of post-secondary grants from Ottawa, right? And these are grants for almost overwhelmingly things that are, you know, boring science, boring engineering stuff, boring research stuff, but they want to be able to vet research and I guess test it for socialism, for wokeness. And again, this is the kind of stuff that authoritarian regimes do. It will harm the institutions in Alberta. It will harm post-secondary. It will harm the ability to create a society where you know, learning and knowledge are apolitical, or at least not overtly political. And that is all part of an agenda by this government that it sort of seeks to attack and undermine sources of power within society that it thinks are not loyal to its cause. So universities, municipal governments, journalism, what have you. And you know, it's not Trumpism, but it is certainly taking pages from the book that the Trumpists read from and are planning to read from again in November. And we would do well to kind of pay attention here a little more. So there's now some protests cropping up later this month. I think I'm going to be speaking at one of them in Calgary. But, you know, I think people who believe in civil society and believe in the institutions that protect it have a responsibility to speak up.
Isn't part of a better society is the challenging of those institutions from time to time, though?
Of course. Challenge away. Challenge them in the venues in which they are you know, appropriate to be challenged in. You know, if you think
well, and that's what you're talking about is the stress test. That's what we're going through. And I talk to people that are upset by protests, right? Or upset, mm-hmm. You know, you're going to a protest yourself, by the way, wouldn't be caught dead at one. But good for you. I'm glad that you feel convicted enough to spend a Saturday or Sunday afternoon telling people what they need to hear. But there's this mob mentality that exists with these people, you know, and I have this mind to you know, specifically when it comes to these issues, this mind to politics and ideologies that are hand in hand, and saying to people that we're only going to do business that share this ideology with us, which is Bill 18, which mm-hmm. is what you're saying, which is like, hey, listen, we want to make sure that Alberta gets its own. We want to make sure that we're rewarding people for doing things and we're not rewarding people who don't understand our ideology. That in itself is highly undemocratic.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. And there's also like deep irony in the fact that, you know, a government that has made more hay on the Ottawa doesn't understand us file than I think any in Alberta history. And that's saying something, because that's been a very consistent theme, certainly among conservative governments here, is doing the same thing to local governments. Right. The idea that the government in Edmonton knows better for Calgary than what Calgarians do and how Calgarians have voted is insulting, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and what this bill does, you know, it's interesting because they've sort of said, well, you know, we're only going to use this in very exceptional circumstances, and you know, it's really just sort of an emergency measure in case we need it. But it puts this giant, I don't know what the metaphor would be, but something on the table in every municipal government, in every council, that says you don't really have any power here. Right. Like you were democratically elected and you can make decisions. But if we decide that we don't like your decisions, we're going to change them. And it sort of emasculates and neuters all of these democratically elected local governments. And again, if you're someone who believes in democracy and believes that democratic accountability is important, you have to oppose this. I don't see how you can't, even if it helps your side, even if it advances your, you know, your campaign to own the libs or your campaign to piss off smart people, which seems to be a large part of conservative politics these days. If you actually care about democratic accountability, I don't see how you can possibly support this.
You nailed it. You nailed it. Is that conservatives are legitimately in overdrive trying to just piss smarter people off. Like, and yeah. It's nonstop. And, you know, part of it is like, as someone who doesn't mind a good fist fight in the streets, part of it's like, yeah, I get it. And part of me understands the challenging of our elites and the institutions in this country. I go back to that stress test thing you did. Like, I'm a big fan of first principles. I think that we should scrap the Conservative Party. We should scrap the Liberal Party. We should change the electorate. We should change how we do things. And we should have better responsible government by better responsible people who are actually interested in this. And we should pay people properly to do that job. And we should have triggers in place. We should have a foreign registry. We should have the ability to recall. We should have more accountability when it comes to putting these people together for us. And I think that it's funny, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, et cetera, et cetera. I think when we talk to other people on other sides as two people that I think are fairly progressive in certain capacities and have sensibilities and values that are offended by sensibilities and values on that side of the equation, I couldn't agree more with what they're saying, right? And that's really the frustrating part for me is that, you know, I agree with the first principles of let's challenge these institutions. Let's say, hey, we're going to put you on notice to do things better for the people of this country. But then they go and do shit like this, right? Where it's like, no. You're going back on what you said you were here to do, or you're at least baiting and switching everybody who's decided to support you into what we all thought you were going to do anyway. And it stands, and it's happening in Nova Scotia. It's happening in Saskatchewan. It's happening in this province with Doug Ford on a corruption level. On just a legal level, it's happening in this province. And my question is it okay for people from all walks of life who identify these things, who can see chess instead of checkers, to actually do business together, to say, hey, we're going to challenge you. We're going to challenge how you're doing business. And I get what in a microcosm what you're talking about in Alberta with very self-serving, somewhat autocratically leaning policies that they're trying to put in place. But this is when everybody kind of comes out, right? This is when people start going, hey, wait a second. I need to pay attention to what's going on in my own province. To my point, isn't that good for us? Aren't we in a place where these conversations should be happening?
I think it's hard in the current culture for people to criticize or disagree with what is perceived as their side. I mean, I think that's a big part of the problem is that we shouldn't have sides, quote unquote, that are as restrictive and all-encompassing as we seem to right now. You should be able to agree with some people on some things and other people on other things. And I think anytime you get into a space where it's all or nothing, that is a space that you should be trying to exit as quickly as possible. And so I have plenty of respect for, you know, people of principle on any political tradition who are willing to call out their own side when they say, hey, hold on, this is not the thing that we're supposed to be doing. This is not the thing that we're supposed to believe in. I also think that it's a litmus test for those people. You know, if you put yourself out there in the world as a person of principle, as someone who, you know, holds themselves to an ideological position, when the politicians that you normally support go against that position, you have to call them out, or you never believed those things in the first place. You only believed in power. And, you know, that is, I think, kind of a moment of truth for people who are more partisan or more politically engaged. You know, I call people shit on me for you know, being totally in favor of the Liberals all the time, and anyone who's read my work knows that's not true. But I've called them out for years now on dropping the ball on housing. I've called them out for a while now on the carbon tax and how they've completely mishandled.
Yeah, you put out a tweet today that had the Conservatives in the lead by 20 points with that younger demographic, 18 to 34. And you put out a tweet, you're like, it's fucking housing. Like, yep. It's super, super simple, and it's the Liberals' fault. Like, we all understand how unaffordable this is and the lack of communication from this government, the piss-poor job that they've done. You've been at the front of that. Yep. And I'm amazed that you get pushback from people when you're like, I want to talk to Eva Chipiuk today. It's like, see, you're doing the full heel turn, Max. Heel turn. Look at you. You're going the way of everybody else. You're following the money, Max. How much do you get that?
I mean, look, there's definitely more money on the conservative media, you know, grifting side than there is being a progressive journalist with Canada's National Observer. But I don't do this for money. I do this because it's the thing I like to do. And, you know, I was it sounds corny and hokey, but I was raised by people who taught me to tell the truth. So I kind of can't go the other way. But that doesn't, you know, that part of that is disagreeing with a government that by and large does things that I support. You know, when they drop the ball on electoral reform, I've raked them over the coals a bunch of times for it. You know, same thing on the carbon tax, same thing on housing. So, you know, I do think that if you position yourself as someone of principle, you have to be willing and able to stick by those principles when it doesn't align with your perhaps partisan self-interest.
Yeah, that came out in the carbon tax bullshit, you know, where your province raised, like, I think it was a gas tax. They raised taxes on gas. What was it, 23%, if I'm not mistaken?
Yep.
You know, it was like a 13 cent increase per liter. And, you know, the 3 cents on the dollar with the carbon tax. And you've got people in that province, like, still protesting, still camping out in ditches in Bicycre. With their fuck Trudeau flags going, we're not leaving until the carbon tax leaves. And you're like, hey, guy, are you aware of the 13 cents and the other 7 cents that your premier just tacked on every dollar that you spend on fuel? And he's like, yeah, I'm not concerned about that. I like that tax.
Yes.
That's my favorite tax. I just don't like this
one. I like the tax that I don't get the rebate from, but it's the one where they give me the money back that really upsets me.
Yeah. Well, and I said that to someone the other day. They're like, you know, I can't believe you like Trudeau. I'm like, I don't like any taxes, but you don't use your brain when you protest, right? Like, you're protesting this weird tax, which you're getting money back for. You're actually going to make money on it if you file your taxes. Now, a lot of the problem that people have that are camping out is they probably haven't filed taxes in like 10, 20 years. So it's just correct. One of those things. So they're not going to get that rebate. And you're like, go file your taxes. They're like, if I file my taxes, I go to jail. And you're like, well, then you're kind of between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah. I mean, that ain't that the truth, but, you know, those people, bless their hearts, they're kind of like deadheads. Now they're just going to spend the rest of their lives following the same tune, you know, going from encampment to encampment, protest to protest, trying to capture that you know, that magical moment of 2021 or whatever it was, and
hoping they can get a bowl of chili and someone brought an outhouse. Yeah, I get it.
I mean, yeah. It's a revival tour, and that everyone needs hobbies. So I would suggest that there's probably better ones out there, but you know, fill your boots.
Yeah, fill your boots. This is a nice thing to say to those people. Really, really nice. We're full of it, man. I think, you know, everybody, and here's the other thing is that, you know, I used to be really angry at some of those people. Now, listen, there are some people that will forever be a meme that are involved in both sides of this. You know, I watched this young lady get arrested, Dina Sharif, on the other side of the equation get arrested, and I'm watching all the blue hairs and the people that want exclusive inclusivity come to her defense, right? And then, you know, they said it's my fault. They say it's Karima's fault. It's like, no, it's your fault because you acted that way, dude. And I say that to every single person is you still have a choice as to how you act. Mm-hmm. And that's why I am so fucking fascinated and enthralled with your province. That's why I'm coming. I'm coming out there today. I want to talk to these people who go, you know what, instead of getting a degree or a GED, instead of getting my real estate license, or instead of getting counseling, or instead of like putting money and time into myself, I am going to become a warrior for politicians and policies. Yep. Not only do I don't understand, but I don't benefit, and I'm just going to believe it all because this gives me purpose. Who doesn't want to fucking get into those minds? I do. I do desperately, right?
Yeah, no, and I think it's a good point, which is that I think a lot of progressive journalists have lost the sense of curiosity for why these people think that way. I mean, that was part of why I went on Eva Chipiak's podcast, was I wanted to be able to take an hour to kind of unpack how she thinks about things and understand, you know, when I introduce this fact, how is she going to respond? When I introduce this fact, how is she going to respond? Because it's interesting to me. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's certainly people in that movement that are write-offs, you know, that thrive on hate, that thrive on being angry, that are narcissists, that just want to be on camera. And I have no time for them. But I think there's also another layer under that of people who just want something to do that gives them meaning. Mm-hmm. They want to feel like they're heard. They want to feel like the world still makes sense. And I think those people are reachable in some way, shape, or form. At the very least, they're worth hearing out a little more than maybe we've been willing to in the last little while. And in fairness, you know, when you're in the middle of a pandemic and shit's getting real, you don't have a lot of time to hear people out, right? You don't, you know, when the Germans are bombing London, you don't have a lot of time to hear out the guy down the block who keeps turning his lights on. You're like, can you just turn your fucking lights off and we'll talk about it later? And maybe now is the later part. I think that's one of the areas where the feds have dropped the ball, is they should have done their own national inquiry into the whole pandemic to really kind of get this stuff, lance the boil, really get it to come to the surface, and better understand, you know, what issues do these people still feel are out there? You know, how have they not been heard? You're never going to get everyone, but I think you would have created less material for the grifters to work with than they have right now.
Yeah, I don't think we'd be as divided as we are either, right? Yeah. Like when it's the word sorry, capitulation to some extent, or the understanding that you're going to meet someone somewhere, you're going to put all your shit down and you're going to have a conversation with them. If you're a government member, if you're a human being, if you're a married person, if you're a guy with a bunch of friends and you pissed off your friends, the word sorry goes a long way, right? Mm-hmm. Like being able to say, hey, listen, we're going to apologize because of these things, as opposed to saying, no, we did everything right. And this is the thing that drives a lot of people crazy in the electorate. This is what drives a citizenry crazy, is that, you know, our values and my values dictate, and I'll tell you how my values are. My values are that I'm super accountable. The truth is super, super, super fucking important to me. It's the most important thing in my life, is being able to tell the truth. But that truth comes with my own experience and behavior that has to be accountable in this, right? So when you talk about wanting to have those conversations, I spent the first 2 years of the pandemic literally on fire, like everybody else did, trying to do content, trying to show everybody what the world looks like, trying to tell everybody to be responsible, trying to tell everybody to take responsibility for themselves, that the vaccines were this and masks were this and da 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 da. What was true yesterday might not be true today. And that's really important to remember. And so my values are the same. My virtues are the same. I am here for the greater good. And so the greater good in this case, to your point, is, okay, well, listen, if I am accountable for my behavior and if I know I was aggressive out of pocket, and if I want to go across the street and have a conversation and put everything down and say, listen, I'm sorry if, but help me understand you and you can do the same. There is no other path to a better Canada than that itself, right? There is no other path to healing families, to healing relationships. And dude, this has happened in my family. I'm sure you've got family members too and friends where you're like, I can't even talk to that guy anymore because I don't respect what they think or how they feel. We used to be able to. It still exists. We can still do it today. But we've spent literally 4 years getting hard, right? Like, that's what we've been spending our time doing, is getting hard in our own minds. And some of it is self-preservation. Some of it is like, listen, I just can't think like this anymore. I can't fight with these people anymore. But most of it is, oh my God, what happened to us over the past 3-4 years, right?
Well,
as you point out, you see the deadheads that still exist, but smarter people have to come together and have that conversation about, okay, well, tell me why you didn't or why you did.
Well, right? And the people who profit from us remaining this way are not, generally speaking, the best and brightest among us. You know, the people who profit from people being angry, from people being divided, from people hating each other are, you know, the folks who thrive on that kind of energy. I think it is incumbent upon the government federally, but it's also incumbent upon civil society to kind of break that down a little bit and bring people back into the middle where you can disagree with someone and understand why they felt differently, you know, without seeing them as an enemy or hating them or, you know, casting them aside. And, you know, if for no other reason, then it is going to have an impact on our collective well-being down the road. If we cannot come together the next time there is a public health crisis, and right now we're not in a position where we could, that's going to hurt a lot of innocent people. It's going to hurt a lot of innocent people on, you know, quote unquote, both sides. Mm. If we can't get people to, you know, like we just saw in Alberta this past winter, some of the lowest uptake rates for the flu vaccine we've ever seen. And so we had the worst flu season, I think, in 25 years or something like that, where and all sorts of senior citizens are dying because they're not taking the vaccine. This stuff has spillover effects, and it is spilling over. And I think, you know, if we get a government led by Pierre Poilievre, I don't get a real strong sense that he's going to try to heal the rifts. But we need somebody who's willing to do that, because the long-term consequences are just so, so severe.
What if it's up to you and me?
You mean you and me literally, or you and me as in average citizens?
No, you and me literally. What if it's up to Dean and Max to fix the country? I think we could probably fucking do it.
Two white guys on a mission. I like it.
Yeah. Last question I have for you. Speaking of concern, did you see Alex Manoah last night? Ooh.
Yeah, he's... I mean, here's the thing, and I'm going to put my baseball nerd hat on, but
please,
he was never as good as he looked back in 2021 and 2022. His numbers, he was way ahead of his underlying peripherals. He was not an ace. He was at best a number three, and the pitch clock kind of fucked him. I think he's not in good shape.
Totally.
He just couldn't do it. It's too physically demanding on a guy in his shape to, you know, to be delivering that amount of energy every 25 seconds. So, I think he's definitely trimmed it up a little bit. I think he can be a number four, maybe number four,
not
number
last
five.
Night, no, not, last night he was a seven. Last night he was like a really good bullpen arm, maybe.
Yeah,
it depends on against a righty. That's it. But, like that's what he was last night.
The whole team looks like dog shit, right?
Oh, watch, dude.
Vlad can't hit. Bo can't hit. They need to do something. And the problem is this team is run like a corporation, right? Because it's owned by Rogers. They're run by bean counters. The GM is a bean counter. The president of baseball operations is a bean counter. They're not going to make the big moves they need to. I worry that they have already squandered this core that should have been a World Series contender.
By now. Yeah. No, I agree. It's been tough to watch. It's just shit. Go on. You win two, win, lose two, win one. It's hard.
And it's funny. Like I used to think it was a smart strategy to draft kids of former major leaguers. I don't think it's a smart strategy anymore. I think it used to be the case that kids of major leaguers had, you know, a better mindset, a better sort of, they were better prepared for the challenges of Major League Baseball. But now, because their parents made so much money, I don't think they have the same hunger that maybe a kid out of the Dominican Republic might, or a kid out of, you know, some college in the United States. They don't have that like insane desire to be great that you need to have to be a truly great baseball player. So maybe stop drafting the kids of major. Well, but you know what? Then again, look at the kid in Baltimore, Jackson Holliday, kid of a major leaguer, and he looks like he's going to be incredible. So. What do I know?
He got sent down after like the first couple of days he was there. I don't know if he's up again. I haven't seen him. But to your point, yeah, it's not like hockey. The son of Major League Baseball players do not turn into their dads.
No.
They just don't. Like, and Fernando Tatis Jr. would be that guy in my mind.
Well, it's weird. What you really want is you want the sons of major leaguers who weren't good, right? Because Ken Griffey Jr., much better than his dad. Tatis Jr., much better than his dad. Vlad Jr., not as good as his dad. So you need the like scrubby role player guy, like Dalton Varsho. His dad was like a role player, bench player. He's looking pretty good. So maybe that's the tier to draw from, is like, you know, just made it to the major leagues and then they have a kid.
Then there's Patrick Mahomes, son of a major league baseball player, who's
son of Pat Mahomes, relief pitcher. Yep.
Yeah, dude, he is. And that's, I think about Patrick Mahomes. I was watching the Tom Brady roast yesterday. I don't know if you watched it.
I saw it. I saw it pop up on Netflix.
Yeah. Oh, vicious. Vicious. Did you see when Tom goes up to Jeff and he's like, hey, don't talk about Robert Kraft's massage. Did you see that?
No.
This literally, he's like, dude, don't say that shit again, please, whatever you do. And he's like, okay, I get it. Yeah, it was like one of those moments in a row.
They're gonna start disappearing like Boeing employees.
Yeah. Yeah, dude, that is
Yeah.
That's crazy too. Two Boeing employees are now dead.
Two whistleblowers. Yeah.
Some dude died of like, the last guy died of like an infection no one's ever heard of. It's like, it's a weird infection. We've never heard of it. I'm like, that's not an infection. He got pilled.
Yeah. He got the poison dart.
Dude, we got to talk about that another time. Appreciate you spending some time with me today, Max Fawcett. Ladies and gentlemen, award winner as Canada's top newspaper columnist, even though he works for a digital magazine / newspaper, Canada's National Observer. Go and subscribe and download. It is the most responsible, the most interesting, the most accountable that you will ever encounter in this country. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. Appreciate you and Caroline, yourself, everybody over there does a great job. Thanks so much for taking time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. And maybe we'll get on that two-man Saving Canada from Division project down the road.
Well, I'm coming out there. I'll probably see it tomorrow night. Just clear a little time for me in the afternoon.
Sure. I'll put a little tent up in the backyard.
Yeah, do it. I appreciate it. Airbnb. Right. They're doing that in Toronto. They're making people sleep in tents and calling them Airbnbs now. $400 a night.
Good Lord.
Yeah. Anyway, appreciate it. Thanks, buddy.
All right.
Max Fawcett, ladies and gentlemen. That's it for us. Have a great day. We will be live in Edmonton and Calgary for the next couple of days, hopefully bringing you some stuff. We're going to see if we can't squeeze one podcast out of Parker when we're there. And listen, I meant what I said earlier, and I tweeted about it today. You, some of you think in binary. Some of you think in terms of checkers and not chess. I am going to talk to one of the most influential people in politics. Vehemently disagree with a lot of the things that he stands for. But I like the person. And I trust that he wants to do the same thing. So, David Parker will be next on our podcast coming up this week. And go and subscribe. Download, subscribe anywhere you get your fine podcasts. Google, Apple, Spotify, etc. Google's going away soon. So Spotify and Apple would be your best bet. And you can also, if you're feeling plucky, get our YouTube version of this. You can see the podcast, Cryer Media YouTube, Dean Blundell Show YouTube as well. You can get everything we do on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. I think we're live on Instagram as well. I don't do Instagram. I don't do Facebook either, but I know our people do. So make sure you go there. Twitter, at it's Dean Blundell or Cryer Media on Twitter. Go to cryer.co. For all the details about everything that we do and the people that we work with and all of our podcasts, there's a lot of Cryer Media friends. There really are. That's it for us. Brought to you by our friends at Fact Check. Make sure you join Fact Check's beta testing program. Go to factcheck.io if you would like to test out disinformation killing software. We're looking for more beta people to apply for the beta testing team. And if you want to become a Fact Check verified fact checker, go to factcheck.io, factcheck.io. Do you believe? Also brought to you by our friends at Muse on the Mic. It is the only sexologist podcast where you've got sexologists and sex workers all talking about how to advocate for the industry. Brought to you by Muse Massage Spa, which is at 1290 Finch Avenue West. Go to musemassagespa.com for more details. Redefining Provocative Massage, and their podcast is incredible. They take you on a journey through the industry. They advocate, talk about men, appreciate women, and talk about health. Yes, sexual health. It's very important. Go to Muse on the Mic, and their podcast Patreon is Uncensored, YouTube as well. Muse on the Mic, and go to musemassagespa.com for more details. And we're brought to you by CanTorque, makers of rugged, hardworking torque wrenches, Canada's leading industrial tool experts, the very best in sales, service, rentals, calibration, maintenance, and custom fabrication of industrial torque tools. You can become a distributor, check out their podcast, products, and services on their brand new website, cantorque.com. And if you're looking for a bolting solution by the best in the world, they do it for heavy industry around the world, and you can't find a bolting solution, loosener, fastener, nuts, bolts, you can't find that. Doesn't exist. They make it. They clean it. They repair it. They fabricate it. And they do it to spec. They'll work with you. They do it for heavy industry around the world. Make sure you give Colin and his team an opportunity to help you with your bolting project. Go to cantorque.com today. That's it for us. Have a great day, everybody. Appreciate it. We'll be back tomorrow live from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. God's country. Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.